Hey there, this is Seth Juarez from Channel 9 here with Rowan Miller. What do you do, bud?
I work as a program manager on the Entity Framework team here at Microsoft.
Fantastic.
So my job is making sure we ship a good product, whether that's driving design decisions, triaging bugs, organizing features, or doing whatever else needs doing to make the team run smooth.
Fantastic. So yep. We thought we would do like a really base level 101. And yep. So if you already know about any framework, maybe this is not the video for you. You should skip to some other ones that we're going to be doing hopefully soon.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what is Entity Framework?
So when we talk about Entity Framework is an object relational mapper for the .NET framework. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of two parts in there that are important. An object relational mapper means you want to write .NET code. You want to write against classes. You mm-hmm. want to think in terms of objects. So if you're interacting with a blog from a database, you want to have a blog class that has properties on it, like blog ID and name and URL. Mm-hmm. Now, that's different than how relational databases work. Relational right. databases have tables, and they have foreign key constraints and things like that. Mm-hmm. So the purpose of an object relational mapper is to map objects to relational objects in the database.
I see. So it's sort of like the bridge between what's in your database
yep.
and what's in your code.
Absolutely. A common term that's used or a common phrase is ORM solve the impedance mismatch between CLR classes and a relational database.
Right, because I mean, it's just the way that they are. They're just distinct. They're distinct things.
Yep.
An object has a finite sort of lifespan,
yep.
and it doesn't have to worry about how it's related to other things.
Exactly.
But in a database, you do have to worry about that.
Yeah, and another good example is foreign key constraints. So in a database, if I have a blog that has posts, I represent it as a foreign key constraint.
Right.
In the CLR world, I would probably represent that as my blog class has a list of posts.
Right.
And I don't worry about foreign keys and things like that.
Fantastic. Now, this is something that Microsoft has been working on for a while.
Yeah, the code base has actually been around for a long time. It went through a few things before it turned into Entity Framework. We think back to WinFS and Object Space Days and things
right.
like that. First shipped in VS 2008 Service Pack 1, okay. I think was the first release of it. And it's kind of, we'll look at a version history, it's kind of morphed and moved around a bit over the last, I guess, 7 years now.
I see. So it's been 7 years since we've worked on it.
Yeah, absolutely.
How many versions have there been? Six? Seven?
Well, we actually started at, it's difficult. Some of us call it version 1, some of us call it version 3.5.
Uh-huh.
Realistically, when we talk about version 6, it's probably actually the fourth version of EF.
I see. So how does one work with Entity Framework? Is there like a specific sort of script or workflow of how one even starts to think about these things?
Yeah, so there is. What we actually have some content on that a little bit later, but you can either start by defining your model and then having your database created and maintained from that model, or you can have an existing database that you just want to write some .NET code to access that database.
Right.
So you could point EF at an existing database and say, just give me some .NET classes that I can interact with to represent the database.
So by model, you specifically mean a set of .NET classes?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. When we talk about a model in EF, fundamentally the thing that you interact with is a set of classes.
I see.
And EF has really two different types of classes. One is your actual entity classes. So these represent effectively the tables in your database.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the context that represents the session with the database. So that's kind of like the unit of work wrapper where we query for stuff and we make changes and we save things back out to the database.
So the first one you mentioned is this sort of model first, or some people call it code first as well.
Yep.
Is that a hard thing to do? What does that look like? How do you set that up?
So I've actually got, we're going to run through a table of there's actually four different workflows in here. So we're going to talk about what the four different ones are and when you might use them. And then we'll actually demo a couple of them too a little bit later. So.
Fantastic. Great. So let's move on to the next thing. Recently, Entity Framework has been open sourced.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the decision behind that and why it's something we wanted to do.
Okay, so open source, here at Microsoft, on the Entity Framework team, we have been trying to be more and more open about the way we develop for quite some time now. That started by publishing early previews of our product.
Mm-hmm.
Then we started up the EF Design blog, where we started publishing early specs of features we were working on to get feedback from our customers. So for us, going open source was really just another step on that continuum about taking our day-to-day work and inviting people outside of our team in to help us shape Entity Framework. And so when we went open source, we're not just talking about publishing our source code so people can look at it. We actually accept contributions. Now we have a fairly high bar for contributions.
Right.
Obviously you have to meet the same coding standards and testing requirements that you would if you were sitting in our Entity Framework team
right.
room here at Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we run all the same stringent quality controls. And when we actually ship, we're not shipping under the open source license. We at Microsoft pick it up, we put a Microsoft license on it, we sign the product with Microsoft keys. And so if you're only interested in using Entity Framework, you still get the same supported, licensed, signed product that you're used to.
Right.
But if you want to join us in the development effort, then you can come into the open source code base.
That's fantastic. Have you taken any contributions?
Yeah, we've taken a lot. We'd be well over 100 contributions now.
That's remarkable. Is how have you found the community to be when it comes to this open source sort of project?
We've had really good uptake. I'd say there's probably two main classes of people who make significant contributions. One is people that use our product and they have a feature they want. Uh-huh. And so we've had some good, usually fairly small features, but useful things that customers really want. The other class that we get a lot of contributions from are people who extend Entity Framework. So these could be people that write database providers or other such things that build on top of EF. And so they will often hit limitations. And historically, they would have had to work around those.
Right.
Or request a fix from us and wait a year till we ship.
Right.
Now they can come in and they can actually make the changes as they go, fork our code base, get everything working how they want, and then send us a pull request for the suggested changes.
That's remarkable. So since this is a 101 sort of introductory video, do you have just something you can show us just to how to even start?
Yeah, absolutely. Before we do that, can we just talk about the history of EF?
Yes, I do. Let's
do that, because that might help put things in context. Actually, the other point I wanted to make, going back to the definition of EF, we said it's an ORM. It's also for the .NET framework.
Okay.
So if you're writing C# or VB.NET code, then you can make use of EF in things like WinForms or WPF or console applications or ASP.NET. So it's not tied to just WPF. It's kind of a cross-cutting concern you can use across .NET applications.
So in any .NET anything, you can use Entity Framework.
So actually, we'll talk about more about that when we get to Entity Framework 7.
Okay.
But at the moment, we're talking about things that target the full .NET framework.
Got it.
So this would be, I target .NET 4.5 or 4.5.1 or something like that. If I'm targeting .NET Core at the moment with EF 6, then EF is not an option for me. But that is something we're opening up in 7.
That's a really good distinction.
Yep.
All right. So let's go on and move on. Let's see what we got.
Okay, so we've got a slide to kind of guide us through the version history.
Okay.
So I mentioned EF didn't really start with version 1, mm-hmm. and that's because EF was tied to the .NET framework. Mm-hmm. So the first two releases we had were Entity Framework 4, mm-hmm. which built on top of Entity Framework, which didn't really have a version number. We just released it. We called it Entity Framework. It was part of the .NET framework.
And 4 is a really nice round number.
Exactly, yeah. And 3.5 Service Pack 1 just rolls off the tongue.
That's right. So, that's right.
Yeah. So these first two versions, the runtime was completely in the .NET framework. Uh-huh. You installed the .NET framework. You got system.data.entity.dll mm-hmm. as part of the .NET framework. And the tooling shipped in Visual Studio.
Okay.
This was nice. It got EF out to a whole bunch of developers. But the problem is it's a slow-moving pattern for us because the .NET framework doesn't ship every few months. It ships every couple of years.
Yeah.
Right? So for us to make changes, we could make them. But then it was very difficult for us to get those into customers' hands.
I see.
So then we started building on the core components that are in the .NET framework. We started building on those with some out-of-band components. So we shipped a few patch releases or minor releases on top of 4. So mm-hmm. this was primarily 4.1. We introduced the DB context API and the mm-hmm. code first workflow. And then we had 4.2 and 4.3 and a few other releases on top of that. Mm-hmm. And then we also shipped the next major version in this same model where we have some out-of-band parts that ship on NuGet that still build over the core of Entity Framework
right.
that is part of the .NET framework. Now, this model gets us a long way because it means simple fixes to those components that extend the core, we can ship them as soon as we want to.
Right.
If we want to do something that is a fundamental change to EF, so a good example of this would be introducing spatial data types.
Right.
That required stuff right throughout the core of Entity Framework, which meant we needed to wait for a .NET framework release.
Because it goes all the way down.
Yep, yeah. Absolutely. And so Entity Framework 5 has some features that just light up when you target .NET 4.5 because we put the spatial stuff into the core components.
Makes sense.
So this was a good step in the right direction, but it's still not where we want it to be.
Okay.
So then we came to Entity Framework 6, which is our current stable release. And when we did this, we took all of the stuff that was in the .NET framework. We obviously don't delete anything from the .NET framework because that would break people.
Right.
We basically took a copy of that. We moved it out of band into the NuGet packages. And then we now have our core shipping out of band on NuGet along with the rest of EF, which means we can change anything and ship anything at any point.
And that's got to be a lot better because if you find a problem, like say you find a problem shortly after release, and you have to wait until the next framework release, that's going to be a cumbersome issue to solve.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually the most common place where we use this. If you ship a major version of anything, you're never going to catch every bug that you introduce.
No, it's just not possible.
And so what we usually find, the time we most appreciate being out of band is we've just shipped a major release, we broke something that's an obscure corner case for us, but right. for somebody it's part of their mission critical application.
Right.
We can now spin a patch release very quickly and have it out there.
And how many patches have you put out for Entity Framework? Has there been a lot?
Not a huge amount. We've done, with EF6, we're up to 6.1.3. So we've done 3 patch releases on 6.1. I think we did 1 patch on 6.0. And then at the moment, our next release is going to be EF6.2. That will be our next stable release.
So work on Entity Framework 6, because I know there's 7, we'll talk about 7 in later videos, but we're still going to work on patching 6 while we work on 7 too.
Yeah, and I would say even a little bit more than patching, we're probably not going to go back and retrofit big features to EF6.
I see.
So we shouldn't expect any fundamental game-changing new big features on EF6.
Okay.
But you should expect minor updates beyond just patches. We're not just going to fix bugs. We are actually accepting new features, and we will spend more time.
Because Entity Framework 6, again, is open source. And
absolutely.
So someone finds something that they want to do a pull request and it fits everything, then yeah, we'll take it.
Yeah, absolutely. All and right. we've done 6.1, 6.2, 6.3. Some of the contributions we took, we decided they weren't really patch contributions. These were new features, so that warranted the change. Instead of it's not going to be 6.1.4, it's going to be 6.2. Because there's new features in there, it's not just bug fixes.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So where are we at with Entity Framework 6? Looks like there's a little bit more space in your slide here.
Well, actually, I was just leaving the bar open. Entity Framework 7 is going to ship in this same model, completely out of band. We're going to dedicate a whole video to Entity Framework 7 because there's quite a lot to drill into there. But Entity Framework 7 follows the same model, but has some fundamental differences than past releases of Entity Framework.
Fantastic. So, all right. So is it time? Is it demo time yet?
Yeah, let's drop out to demos.
All right, let's do that.
All right. So I'm going to open up Visual Studio. Well, actually, let's take a quick look at the workflows slide. We missed that one.
Oh, well, let's do that, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So we mentioned there were 4 workflows.
Right.
Two decisions or two dimensions decide what workflow is best for you. The first one is something you don't control. Are you targeting a new database, like a greenfield application, or are you building an application that targets an existing database?
I see.
Which is arguably in the enterprise, probably the majority of applications.
Right, because usually in large enterprises, you have the DBA, and they say, this is the database structure.
Yeah, or you're doing integration with an existing big system that you bought off the shelf, and need to interact with that existing schema too.
Fantastic.
Yep. The second pivot is completely up to you, and that is what workflow or what method do you prefer to develop a model with? Would you like to have boxes and lines on a canvas?
I see.
Or would you prefer to just write code?
Okay.
All right, so this gives us four boxes to fill in. So model first is where I design my model using boxes and lines, and then I generate the database from that model.
Okay.
The actual classes that I'm going to interact with and write my application code against, they are generated for me based on the boxes and lines that I draw.
I see. And these boxes in line tend to look fairly similar to relational diagrams.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Somewhere between a relational diagram and an object model.
Got it.
Database first, I'm still in the designer, but instead of starting drawing my boxes and lines, I point the designer at a database and it draws the boxes and lines for me.
Got it.
Again, the classes that I'm going to actually write my application code against, they're generated for me based on the boxes and lines on the canvas.
Okay.
And then on the other side, we have the code-centric approach. Which I mentioned came online in EF4.1.
Uh-huh.
We've actually been seeing really strong adoption on this. I would say it's at least 50-50 now, if not the majority of people are using the code-centric approach.
Cool.
All right, so code first, obvious name. I write my code. I write my domain classes. I write my context. I maybe write some extra mapping in code to say this is how these classes should map to the database. And then my database is generated for me based on those classes.
Got it.
Now, one of the great things about code first is we have migrations. So if I change what my classes look like, I don't have to blow my database away and recreate it. I can do incremental changes to the database and push those.
So once you make a code change, what's going to happen is Entity Framework somehow knows the change that happened and how to migrate the database forward?
Yeah, absolutely. There's some gestures that you would do as a developer to say, work out what changes need to be applied.
Okay.
We'll show you. You can edit them if you want to. And then we go and apply those to the database.
So does it look at the database to see what those changes are? Does it look at the code changes? How does that even work?
It actually keeps a snapshot of your model and says, so last time you generated a migration, this is what your model looked like. looking at your code, I can work out what your model looks like now, and then I can diff those two and work out what changed.
I see, and that happens just with Entity Framework.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the last box, Code First, was a really bad name. It was a marketing decision, but what we probably should, or I should say a marketing-based decision, I'm not blaming the marketing department, but a better name for it would have been code-only or code-based modeling. And it was actually originally internally called code-only. Now, the reason I say Code First is a bad name is because you can actually use Code First against an existing database, which the name doesn't really imply. So what we really have is in the code-centric approach, we have model first, where I write the code, or we have database first, where I have a database and I generate my code-based model from that database.
I see. And then also, with the code only, you could create special mappings to your database somehow. Is that true too?
Yeah, so you don't just, it doesn't have to be a one-to-one mapping. The things you could do in the designer where you can say, well, my property is called blog ID, my column in the database is called blog underscore ID, because that's what my DBA likes.
Right.
You can do the same thing in code.
Got it.
Okay.
Cool.
All right, so I mentioned that the code-centric approach or the code-based approach to modeling is becoming way more popular, and we're actually seeing the designer-centric approach is based on having a single XML file that contains the definition of your whole model.
Look, I've worked on some applications where there were hundreds of tables.
Yep.
Does this become a problem in the design-centric approach?
It does, both because the designer slows down, which is a performance issue, which we could address that, but also just the having your whole model expressed in a single file that is XML-based doesn't lend very well to mergers, especially when you're working with source control.
Right.
You can imagine diffs and mergers and things like that become a bit unruly. Whereas source control tools are extremely good at diffing and merging source code.
Of course.
So in EF7, we're actually moving away from the XML-based file format.
I see.
And moving to just have code-based models.
Okay.
Now that doesn't preclude having a designer on top of them. In this stage, we're not building a designer in EF7. We'll talk more about that later. But it just means that instead of having XML and code, we're just focusing on the code-based models moving forwards.
So in any framework 7 then, there could be a situation where there's a database first and the classes will be generated for you?
Absolutely, okay. Same as there is these days.
Got it.
This bottom, this last quadrant we talked about on this diagram is exactly that. I point a tool at a database and it generates my code-based model for me.
Fantastic.
All right. Now let's go demo.
Let's do some code, man. I'm looking for code here.
All right, so Visual Studio, I'm using 2015, the release candidate that's out at the moment. Okay. You can do this in 2012, you can do this in 2010.
Now, just for clarification, we're doing some EF6 stuff right now.
Yeah, okay. We're not gonna touch EF7 in this. So this is, you can do this today with stable bits that are shipped and supported and all of that.
All right.
So we're gonna do a new project. I'm just gonna do a console application to keep things simple. When that fires up, we're going to right-click and add a new item. Now, the item that we're going to add to our project is an Entity Framework model.
Okay.
All right, so we'll go under the Data tab and do the ADO.NET Entity Data Model. Now, folks might expect this to be called Entity Framework Model, which would actually be sensible. Entity Framework is built around the concept of the model being an Entity Data Model.
Right.
And the idea of that is that it's a common way of describing a model, common way of describing entities and properties and relationships between them. So entity data model and entity framework model are kind of synonyms for the same thing.
Okay.
We're going to call this one blog context. Now, the four options I have here basically correspond to the four squares we just looked at on that diagram. So I can do an EF designer-based model, either from a database, or I can start and generate a database, or I can do an empty code-based model, or code-based model from an existing database. So let's do code-based from a database.
Got it.
When we demo EF, we typically tend to focus on building your model first and then generating the database, which is fun to demo, and it's good for some applications, but I think the majority of real developers target an existing database. Yeah. So we're actually going to start with this one today.
Let's do that.
Just to reassure folks that this is a first-class citizen. Now, right. It's not something we tack on at the end. Now, I have an existing database here. I have Local SQL Express running here, and I have a database that's called blogging, and it has some simple tables in here, blogs, posts, tags, authors.
And they're all related with foreign keys, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. So we go back to Visual Studio, go through the connection dialog, so we're going to point this at our existing database.
There you go.
So that's our blogging database. We'll see here it's going to store the connection string in our application config. I'm using integrated security, so there's no passwords or anything in here. if there were passwords, it would warn me and suggest that I don't store those in my app config.
There's way too many of those hiding around on GitHub right
Absolutely,
now,
yeah. All right, so at this point, we choose what items from the database we want in our model. So we could choose a subset. You'll see things are grouped under schema to try and help you out a bit.
Right.
In our case, we just want everything, so we'll pull it all in. You'll notice here we can also pull in views.
Mm-hmm.
So hit finish on that. NEF's just going to look at the schema from my database. It's going to work out what the model should look like. And then it's generated a bunch of code for me.
Now, that code now you can edit yourself.
Yes.
Okay.
And we'll actually look at that in a second. Okay. So first up, let's just look at one of the classes it generated. So you'll see these are pretty simple classes. This is a post class. It represents the post table in the database. I have some properties here like author ID, which points to the author. And then, of course, author is also represented down here as what we call a navigation property. So this will actually point to an instance of the author class.
Got it.
So we get both the foreign key and the navigation property. I don't have to have the foreign key in here. I can take it out if I want. But we find things tend to work a lot better when you actually have the foreign key in the class.
Right.
Okay, so that's the actual entity classes I'm going to interact with. We can go look at the context. Remember, this represents a session with the database.
Right.
So this inherits from DB context, which is a type in EF. It's kind of our central API that everybody uses. And then we expose a DB set for each type in the model. So you can see here we've got a DB set of our authors. This DB set allows us to query against the authors table. Mm-hmm. It also allows us to insert and update and delete data.
So it seems like there's like two classes of, I shouldn't use the word classes, but two types of objects.
Yeah.
There is the one for interaction, and there's the one that represent the physical rows inside the tables.
Yeah, a good way to think about it is the context is kind of synonymous with a connection to the database.
Got it.
The entity classes are more like the tables that you're going to actually query via that connection.
Perfect.
All right, so let's write some actual code. So we're going to use a using statement, and we're going to new up an instance of our blog context.
Okay.
So this is basically, this is the scope of our session with the database. Mm-hmm. First thing we'll do is look at querying some data. So EF uses something called link. Link is not specific to EF, but it's a C# and VB.NET,
right.
.NET native query language. It stands for language integrated queries. So we're going to say from B in db.blogs. Blogs being the DB set of blogs in our context. Where? Let's not do it where. Let's just order by the name.
Okay.
So we're going to order by the name of the blogs. This would be an ascending alphabetical sort. Select B. So that's going to select the actual blogs from the database.
Got
so
it.
What this variable contains is a queryable of blog.
Mm-hmm. And for those that are watching, the interesting thing about link is that right now, there's nothing in blogs until you actually pull.
Exactly. So if I ran this code, there would be no round trip to the database.
That's right.
Yep.
And that's important because it was something that threw me off a couple years ago when I started looking at this. I was, as soon as you start to enumerate through it, it's going to pull.
Yeah. So if I wanted, say I did want blogs to be populated with this, I could append on the end of this. We could wrap all this.
Like a to list or something.
Yeah, and we could do a to list. So there's like to array, to list, first, single, stuff like this actually pulls the data from the database. But while it's sitting there as a query, it's just a query and it hasn't actually been executed.
It's an iQuery,
iQueryable.
So you can actually go to, for example, do blogs and then dot where and dot order after that.
Yeah, so I can keep composing is right. The word that we typically use with link. I can compose on top of it. Now, another way, you mentioned enumeration, so we'll just go over it here. So for each item in blogs, and then let's just write the name of the blog out to the console.
Okay.
All right, so we'll run.
Don't forget the console.readKey.
Control F5 will actually give that for you.
Oh, I did not know.
Runs
that.
Without the debugger, but it will give you.
Control F5.
There we go. Top tip. Okay, so we can see I happen to have two blogs in the database, and it's written out the names of those.
Now, let me ask you a question. Let's go ahead and hit enter on the keyboard here. Notice that you're only actually looking at name. Does that queryable fetch the entire row?
It does fetch the entire row because I'm enumerating over it here. If I just wanted the names, I would say blog.name. Now all I'm going to do is pull the name back from the database.
So
this is a much more efficient query. So if all I wanted was a subset of the properties, then I would do this. And then, of course, I wouldn't need the dot name because the item that I'm enumerating is the name. And so I could run this again and I would have a smaller query sent to the
database. And this would be a more efficient thing as well. Okay. Yeah. It's good to know because sometimes I've seen people just query this ginormous thing.
Yeah.
Only look at one field.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that feels a little wasteful to me.
Yeah, it's definitely a trade-off because there is some nice cleanness in the kind of object-oriented approach of saying, I have a blog, it has all these properties, whoever I give it to can access any of them. Mm. So one feature that we've talked about in EF, we don't have this yet, is the idea of a lazy loader property where I can pass the instance around, but I don't actually get the data until people ask for it.
So. And that the other challenge with that is, let's just say you're enumerating over an object, over a collection.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then you have a lazy property towards, so you're enumerating over blogs, and then you have a lazy property over to author. Mm-hmm. What's the challenge that can happen there?
Yeah, you can end up with basically N plus one round trips to the database. We see this, we do support some lazy loading. We support lazy loading of relationships, which means I can pull in some blogs, and then we'll automatically fill in the posts property when you actually query for it. Mm-hmm. Now that's great if you pull back one blog and then you fill the posts when you ask for it. If you pull back 100 blogs and then you enumerate over them and happen to access
lazily,
the post property,
yeah. You
get 101 queries with the database.
And obviously that's not good for the database and your DBA is going to be upset.
Yeah, absolutely. And your customers too when your app slows down.
Right.
So I think that touches on an important point. One thing that you shouldn't think when you see Entity Framework is, wow, this just takes care of all of the query concerns for me and I don't have to think about queries anymore. That's not true. What this gives you is a C# or VB.NET interface over queries, which is nice because you're used to it and they're written in terms of your objects, you still have to think about the efficiency of what you're writing.
And I think the key here is if you open like a SQL profiler,
yeah,
it's really good to see what's happening. And if you're seeing that thing fill up, yeah. You might want to reconsider the way you're querying things.
Yeah, and there's some nice plugin, mainly for ASP.NET, there's a third-party component called Glimpse, which will give you a really nice look at what's happening. And that's a spot that would be great to see filled for some other applications too. We don't really have that for console apps or WPF or other applications.
Right.
Yeah.
But seriously, you could open up the SQL Server profiler and just see the queries that are coming in.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what that takes is a conscious effort on the part of the developer to think about the efficiency of what they're writing.
Got it. Cool.
All right. Okay, so we looked at query. Let's quickly look at insert, update, and delete as well, which is the other part of EF. So if I wanted to create a new blog, I literally just new up an instance of my blog class. Let's just set the name property on here. Now that gives me an instance of the class. I need to actually register it with the context. So I'm going to go to the blogs property and add the blogin. So this means when I call save changes, which I'm about to write a line of code for, then I'll take that instance of the blog and insert it into the database. Now I mentioned unit of work. What that means is that EF, the context, stores up all the changes. It doesn't instantly write them to the database. Mm-hmm. And then when you call save changes, it effectively like flushes all the pending changes out to the database.
Got it.
This is nice because I can kind of coordinate a whole set of changes and then write them all to the database at once. I don't have to think about the right order to put things in. So if I add a blog and I add four posts, I don't have to worry about adding the four posts, so adding the blog and then the four posts. EF will do a topological sort for me.
So you just call the DB object, which is the blog context.
Yep.
You do a lot of changes,
but
only until you do save changes will it push all of the stuff out.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's good because we don't want this sort of application to be overly chatty with the database.
That's right. And you know, you can also envisage in like thick client applications, I want to have a save button. So I don't want to write everything out in real time necessarily. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to let the user work in their workspace and then click save and push everything out. And so this matches that model. I call save changes when they push the save button.
And there's also a notion, and I don't know how this is modeled in any framework, but if any of those changes fail, you might want to roll back everything.
Yeah, so EF does that by default. By default, save changes is always transactional. So everything succeeds or nothing gets written.
And that's important,
yeah,
right? Because if you're
important.
Debiting and crediting,
yeah.
And so if both of them don't happen, you're kind of hosed the system.
Yeah, and you can if you want to like coordinate transactions between contexts. We have APIs to kind of do advanced transaction patterns if you want to. But by default, it either all succeeds or it all fails.
Fantastic.
Okay. All right, so let's run this. And we'll see when we're iterating over the results, we have our new blog coming out. I'll just pop out to the...
It is.
So we can see the new one in there. We didn't give it a URL, which is why it's null. So we'll close out that one. All right, so now we've seen insertion, let's go take a look at what an update looks like.
Okay.
So we're gonna query back some data from the database. So I don't really mind which blog I get, so I'm just gonna pull the first one. Okay. First being an extension method that I get because of link.
And this is actually executing a query.
Yeah, because okay. I'm saying I want one, same as to list where I want all of them, it actually runs the query and pulls it back. Now, the context is gonna take care of tracking changes to the object for me. So I'm just gonna change the name to, we change this. And again, this is just stored up in memory until I actually push the changes to the database. So I'm gonna call save changes and we'll go ahead and run. And we'll see in the list of names that get printed out, the updated name is there. So this is nice, I don't have to think about update statements or anything like
right.
that.
Right, that's really cool.
Yep. Now, the other thing we talked about is EF supporting mapping as well. So my properties don't have to be called what they are called, the mm-hmm. columns are called in the database. So let's go take a look at that. We'll actually look at renaming this name property. So by default, when EF builds a model, it will use the property name as the column name. So let's change this.
And that's a challenge, right? Because there's some old school DBAs that have everything in all caps and underscores still.
Yep, absolutely. So let's change this to display name. Now, if I tried to run the application now, I'd get an exception message because display name is not what the column is called. To fix that, I can just go and tell it that the column for this is just called name.
I see.
And then my C-sharp code obviously is using display name, but Entity Framework is going to map that to a column called name.
Got it.
Now there's two options for configuration. I can either do it in my class using attributes, or if I don't want to pollute my class with attributes, and folks in the kind of following domain-driven design principles often don't want to put data access-oriented stuff in their classes.
They want to separate concerns a little bit more.
Absolutely, yeah. So the other option we have is a Fluent API, and here's some examples of things configured in the Fluent API. So I could pull up the blog class and rename the column here as well.
Okay. Yep. And this is code that was generated for the blog context.
Yeah, so this was generated, this particular example here, because by default, EF will assume that a required relationship has cascade delete configured on it. I see. In my case, my database doesn't follow that convention. And so EF is generating this particular bit of configuration here to say that the relationship between a post and its author does not cascade delete.
Oh, it does not. Okay,
yeah.
So I see.
I'm changing the default.
And just for those that are watching that don't know what a cascade delete, it's when, like, if you delete an author, then all his posts should be gone.
Exactly.
Or all her posts should be gone.
Yep, that's exactly right, yeah. All right, you can see here, too, we have a many-to-many relationship between posts and tags. Mm-hmm. The name that EF would come up with for that table does not match the one that I have in my database. Mm-hmm. And so we have some mapping generated here to say that the table is called post tags, and I have post ID is one of my primary keys and tag ID is
another.
So the Fluent API is the most powerful way to do mapping. You can do some things here that you can't do with the attributes.
I see.
Yep. Okay, so that's kind of a demo of targeting an existing database. I thought we might do a quick demo of what the other workflow looks like.
Let's
where
do
I
it.
Start by writing code. So we'll start with a new app. I'm gonna make this one quite a bit simpler just because we've kind of seen how EF works now. So if I'm going to use Entity Framework, I need to have Entity Framework installed. Now, when I use the EF Designer, it put EF in my project for me. Now, I'm stepping outside the realm of a designer, and I don't want any of that taken care of for me. So the first thing we're going to do is add EF. Now, I mentioned EF ships out of band as a NuGet package. So we're going to go manage the NuGet packages. You'll see here, this is the NuGet UI from Visual Studio 2015. If you're using 2012 or something else, then the UI will look a little bit different, but fundamentally you can do the same things.
Yeah.
So we're going to install Entity Framework. We want the latest stable one, which is 6.1.3. So I'll install that. And that's going, it's downloading the assemblies from NuGet and referencing them in my project.
Got it.
So we can see over here in Solution Explorer that I now have a reference to Entity Framework and Entity Framework.SQL Server.
Now that brings up a good question. Does Entity Framework only work with SQL Server?
No, we have a provider model, and there's third-party providers for almost any relational database you could want to target. In EF6 and previous versions, the provider for SQL Server is baked into the core of EF.
Got
so
it.
You install EF, even if you want to target Oracle, you still end up with the SQL Server provider mm-hmm. Reference from your application. We're actually fixing that in EF7. So in EF7, you install EF, you would only get the core. You install Oracle provider, you only have the Oracle provider reference, not the SQL Server.
Got it. And those providers come down via NuGet?
Most of them ship via NuGet.
Okay.
Yeah. We're trying to push most provider writers to use that methodology.
Got it.
Okay, so now obviously I don't have any model generated for me in this class. So we'll create a new class quickly. We'll call it blog. We'll work with a similar model. We need to give everything a primary key, so I'll call it blog ID. And we probably want a name for the blog as well, say. All right, so that gives us our domain model. The other class we need to remember is the context. So we'll call this one blog context. Remember, it needs to inherit from DB context.
Okay.
I need a using for system data entity. Go ahead and add that for me. Someone code reviewing here. Remember, we need a DB set for each type in the model.
And in this case, we have a blog.
All right. Now, this is actually all I need to do in CodeFirst. CodeFirst will build my model by looking at my context. It will look at all of the DB sets I have,
uh-huh.
and it will assume that those are included in my model. It will then run some conventions over those. So if I have a property that's called either ID or the type name followed by ID, EF will assume that's the primary key.
Okay.
And in my case, I follow that convention.
Right.
It'll pick some default data types for me. And actually, by default, in EF6 at least, it will pick a default database for me.
And what's the default database in this case?
It's going to be the fully qualified name of my context. So in our case, that will be console application5.blog context.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be on whatever version of a local database I have installed. So if I have SQL Express, which is what I happen to have, it'll put on SQL Express. If I have LocalDB, it will put it on LocalDB for me.
I see.
This is actually something we're changing in 7 because this is great for demos and it's great for your very first couple of minutes with EF. It's not so great after that because it's kind of magical and you don't really know what's happening.
And the other thing about magical things that I, like, we're devs.
Yeah.
Like, there's no magic in this. Something is happening and I want to know where it is and
exactly.
What's going on.
So what you'll actually see in EF7, we override a method in 7 called onConfiguring and I say, this is the database I want to target, which makes things a lot clearer. All right, so remember at this stage, we have our model defined.
Right.
EF's going to use conventions to work everything out. Now, if the conventions didn't work for me, like my primary key was called something else, mm-hmm. then I could use annotations or the Fluent API to further configure. We saw that in the last demo I did.
We did.
Cool. All right. So now we want to create a database. And to do that, we use something called migrations. So I'm going to open up Package Manager Console. When we installed the Entity Framework NuGet package, it registered some commands in Package Manager Console for
us.
So one of those is called enable migrations. So we'll just give it a minute to find enable migrations. Now run that command, it's going to kind of bootstrap my project ready to use migrations.
And so what is it actually doing? I feel like there's some black boxiness going. Oh, yep. It's making a class.
So it made a folder called migrations, and we'll see that a migration is a piece of code that tells me what to do to the database.
Right.
We haven't added any yet, so there aren't any. And then it added a configuration class, which is basically the settings for migrations.
Got it.
If we go and actually look at what's in this class, we'll see there's not a lot happening in here at the moment. I have a place where I can put some seed data if I want to.
I see. And by seed data, you mean let's fill some rows in just to have something show up.
So there's two uses for this. One, I can use this while I'm developing locally to put some data in my database. Mm-hmm. Or I might have some lookup tables that I want to pre-populate.
Right.
Maybe I have a day of the week table that I always want with the 7 days of the week, mm-hmm. so I could fulfill that.
That makes sense.
All right, so now that we have migrations enabled, we can use another command called add migration. Migrations have names, so I'm going to just call this one my first migration. And what that's going to do is look at the current state of my database, or look at actually the state of the model the last time my migration was generated.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't generated any migrations yet, so that's an empty model. Mm-hmm. It's also going to look at the current state of the model, which mm-hmm. has a blog class with a blog ID and a name property, and it's going to work out what needs to happen to the database to make it respect those changes.
And in this case, since there is none, it's going to have to make it.
Yep, and it's going to have to create a blogs table, we'll see here. So this is a migration. So a migration says what to do to the database. So it's going to create a blogs table with a blog ID and a name property column and with a primary key being blog ID.
It looks like also, if you're looking at this, you could literally encode, create your own database using this style of coding.
Absolutely. This isn't anything particularly new to EF. This is machine migrations, mm-hmm. Fluent Migrator, even Ruby on Rails has a similar approach to this. So this is a kind of well-known pattern for maintaining databases.
Okay.
Now I can edit this code. This may not be right. I could actually add more columns in here. If I wanted some columns in the database that aren't part of my EF model, I could add those in here.
Right.
Now, one other thing to call out, a migration is a well-ordered set of steps to be applied to the database. So you'll see here we have, over in Solution Explorer, my migration has a date stamp on the front of it, or date timestamp. And this says, do everything in this order. And so if I have 6 migrations, I might target a new database, and when I do that, it has to apply all six of them.
Right.
Or I might have one that has the first three applied, but not the second three. And so migrations can look at any database and say, these are the migrations I need to apply in order to bring this up to the latest
node. Does it do that by looking at the diff of where it is?
It actually stores a table in the database.
I got
that
it.
It's called a migrations history table, and it basically records these IDs that we looked at here to say these have been applied.
And if that table doesn't exist, it's going to just make the whole thing.
Yeah, it assumes that nothing's been done. Now, the thing that's nice about this is because EF isn't doing anything magic under the covers to diff the schema or anything, you know exactly what's going to happen every time.
Right.
So you're not going to end up in, well, my customer happened to be on this particular version of the schema, which we never tested migrating to this other version, and so I get some weird behavior. I always know it's going to do this exact step, and then this exact step, and then this exact step.
Got it.
So it's very predictable. Okay, so now that, I guess we need to make our database.
Yeah.
So we use the update database command to actually push any pending migrations to the database. Our database didn't exist, so it's going to create it, and then it's going to apply the first migration.
Where does it store the connection string?
So the connection string that we're using at the moment is being detected by convention.
Got it.
Which is great for a little demo, or it's great for learning about EF. What I would probably want to do when it actually comes time to write a real application, I would put my connection string in the app.config.
Got it.
And if I call the connection string the same thing as my context, then EF will match the two up and use it.
Got it.
All right, so now if we go to SQL Express and we refresh the databases, we'll see there's the database
there
we talked about. And we'll see two tables in there. We'll see our blogs table there, which matches the schema. Well, the schema is derived from our class. Then we also have this migration history table, which I mentioned keeps track of which migrations have been applied to the database.
Got it.
So let's take a quick look at making a change to the model. So let's introduce a new property in here. We'll call it URL. So I'll add a migration. Obviously, if I ran this app now, I don't have any app code. But if I had some app code and I tried to query, I'd get an exception because there's no URL column in the database.
Right.
So we'll add a migration, I'll just call it URL.
And so when you do add migration, you're giving it sort of a name. I did this. It's kind of like a check-in or a commit of your database.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good way of thinking about it. So if I look over here in Solution Explorer, you'll see I now have the timestamp on the front so that we get the right order and my name there, which is the way I choose to think about it. And you can see here, too, that the only thing we've done since the last migration was added is to add the URL property, which translates to adding a column to the blogs table in the database.
Got it.
And then again, we use update database to push those changes to the database. The way this works, EF is going to look at all the migrations in my project. I have two of them. I have the my first migration in URL. It's going to look in the migration history table, which has the my first migration recorded as applied. So it works out I need to apply the URL, and it'll apply that.
One more change to do.
So then if we go refresh the columns, we'll see the URL is now there in the database.
Perfect.
Yep.
Oh, well, that's not too bad.
Yeah. Yep. All right. So
There's got to be a place where people can go to get started. You probably have a really neat little, there you go.
Yeah. So a few places you can go if you want to kind of interact with the EF team more. We have facebook.com/EFMagicUnicorns and also the EF Magic Unicorns Twitter handle. They're good if you want to just kind of stay up to date with what the team's doing day to day.
Right.
Particularly if you're interested in what we're doing in the open source world.
Got it. So why magic unicorns? Who came up with that?
So Scott Hanselman actually coined this term. So back when we first introduced Code First, we had Entity Framework Community Technology Preview.
I remember 5. This talk that he gave.
Yeah, and we thought it was a good name. It said exactly what it was. It was EFCTP5. Scott didn't agree. He thought it was lame and very Microsofty, so he decided to call it EF Magic Unicorn Edition.
I remember that talk.
We agreed that that was actually a better name after we gave it some thought, and so we've kind of embraced the Magic Unicorn things.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, here's some places where people can go to take a look.
Yeah, so our blog, MSDN blog, is great if you want to kind of stay up to date with releases and things. We always post release announcements there. And then if you really want to dig into the projects themselves, EF6 is on CodePlex. EF7 is being developed on GitHub.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for giving us a little tour of EF6. Anything else you want to add?
Nope. Just looking forward to talking about EF7 in a minute.
Fantastic. Thanks for watching. This is a little bit of a longer introduction, but hopefully it was useful to you in preparation for looking at EF7. Thanks for watching, and we'll catch you next time. Take care.